Hey everyone, welcome back to the Greek Current Podcast. This is Thano, and I'm joined here at HALC headquarters by Andy Zemenidis.
A beautiful day in Chicago.
And we've got on the line, joining our roundtable conversation, Ambassador Patrick Theros, who's a distinguished diplomat with a long career in the U.S. Foreign Service. He's a member on the Council of Foreign Relations. He's the representative to the U.S. of the Greek Orthodox Patriarch of Jerusalem, has served as ambassador, as U.S. ambassador to Qatar, as deputy coordinator for counterterrorism, responsible for all U.S. government counterterrorism activities outside the U.S. And we're very excited to have you on our podcast. So welcome, and thank you for joining us, Ambassador.
Thank you very much for having me. Pleasure.
I want to pick up right where we left off on our last podcast, where we finished our episode discussing the rift that we've seen develop between the Ecumenical Patriarchate and Moscow and the Russian Orthodox Church. We saw reports recently in AP and other places, you know, that Russian hackers indicted by the U.S. special prosecutor actually last month tried to steal the correspondence of senior Orthodox Christian figures, including top aides to the Ecumenical Patriarchate. And the Russian Church recently announced this weekend that it will no longer participate in structures chaired by the Ecumenical Patriarch. So what's the root of these tensions, Ambassador?
There has been, since the founding of the Moscow Patriarchate, the 16th century, 17th century, there has been constant tension between Constantinople and Moscow over influence of the other Christian churches, of the other Orthodox churches. These are it's played out mostly in the Middle East, not so much in Europe, except again in the Ukraine. But even in the Ukraine, it didn't happen so much because by that time the Ottomans controlled the Patriarchate of Constantinople and in fact pushed the Patriarchate to grant authority over the Ukraine, over the Kievan churches, to Moscow, so as to reduce the authority and the power of the Ecumenical Patriarch in Constantinople. Back to the 17th century with the creation of the Moscow Patriarchate. During Mongol times and later under Ottoman times, the Ottomans, Moscow became more important than Kiev. Kiev, we should not forget, is the heart of Russian Orthodoxy. This is where the Vladimir, who was the Archduke of the Rus, first converted to Christianity and established what later became the Russian Orthodox Church. If you remember, the tradition is that the Vladimir had decided that he wanted to stop being a pagan, and he was looking for a modern church, a modern religion for the time to replace paganism, and he considered Judaism, Islam, and the two forms of two sources of Christianity, one in Rome and one in Constantinople. At the time, we hadn't yet split with Rome. All this takes place in the end of the 10th century. 988 is the key date. He gave up on Islam because you couldn't drink and you couldn't eat pork. And that went quickly in Moscow.
Would have killed the vodka industry.
Huh? Yeah, absolutely. Judaism was regarded as too politically unimportant, and everybody was persecuting them. So it was a question of choosing between Rome as the source of Christianity or Constantinople. Like I said, we hadn't broken, but the two churches were already at odds. And our version of the myth is that his representatives were so entranced by the beauty of the liturgy in Saint Sophia in Constantinople that he decided on orthodoxy. I rather suspect, and I think there's enough evidence for this, the fact that the Orthodox tradition, he could have his own church under his own bishop, albeit appointed initially by the Patriarch in Constantinople. And that the language of the liturgy would be in the vernacular, would be in a Slavic language, whereas Rome was offering him a church that was completely controlled by the Vatican, by the Pope in Rome, and the language of the liturgy being in Latin. Mm-hmm. So he came down on our side. Since then, and from the very beginning, there has been constant tension between the Orthodox and the Catholics in the Ukraine. Poles and overran the Ukraine a couple of times. They tried to impose Catholicism. They invented what we refer to as the Uniate churches, which are Orthodox churches in which the hierarchy swore fealty to Catholicism, to Rome, but retained all the external trappings of Orthodoxy. And this has been constantly seen. The Eastern Rite Catholics, or the Uniates, have always tried to sell themselves as the Ukrainian church, and that as the power of Moscow grew, the Orthodox Church was deemed under Russian control. Under the Soviets, when the Russian Revolution first took place, there was actually favor given to both the Uniates and to the Ukrainian National Church, because Stalin in the early days wanted to crush, he abolished the Patriarchate of Moscow, and he wanted to crush the Russian Orthodox Church. Later, particularly when World War II came, and he had to revive Russian Orthodoxy as a national instrument to help fight the Germans, they reversed course. So this idea of Ukrainian autocephaly, Ukrainian independence from Moscow, has been a constant, is a constant source of tension, of violence, frequently of people getting killed. And the Patriarchate of Constantinople has played mostly a mediating and role. They've been the umpire and the referee whenever this is, whenever they've been able to get involved. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, the restoration of the Orthodox Church as the state church of Russia, and particularly with Putin's support of the Russian Church, and Putin is doing with the Russian Church what the Tsars did, is they regarded the Russian Church as an instrument of foreign policy. This has accelerated the rivalry with Constantinople. And the rivalry has played out, as I said, until now, it played out mostly in the Near East, between the control of the various old patriarchates in Antioch, Jerusalem, and Alexandria. But also, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, Constantinople, from Moscow's point of view, was seen as meddling. They've made the Lithuanian church and the Estonian churches semi-independent. They've attempted to support other independent Orthodox churches in Eastern Europe. Now, of course, Romania, Bulgaria, and Serbia have their own patriarchates, and they are independent. But others, there's a Polish National Church that is the mirror image of the Eastern Rite Catholics. These are sort of Western Rite Orthodox. There is a church in Finland. So this is something that has gone back and forth a lot. Politics are at the base of this. There's no theological argument.
Yeah,
no,
I think that's where we would like to get a little more, because clearly, as you pointed out, even with the experience with Stalin, geopolitics moved and determined a lot of what was happening in this inter-Orthodox rivalry. And as we look at what's going on, especially between Russia and the West, you know, I was leafing through Sam Huntington's book this week, Clash of Civilizations, and where he's describing Ukraine as a torn state, right? One of those battleground states that's going to determine the rivalry between a couple of civilizations. And it looks like that's where the rivalry between Russia and the West has come to a head. Now, of course, Huntington's theory doesn't have our church, the Ecumenical Patriarchate, as part of the West. It actually has it under Russian kind of sovereignty anyway, sure, in the Orthodox world. And we know that Putin's version of Rasputin, a quote-unquote philosopher named Alexander Dugin, believes in this Orthodox nationalism. How are both the clash of civilizations theory and present the revived Cold War affecting what we're seeing in the Orthodox Church?
I find it difficult to pay much attention to subscribe to Huntington's on the clash of civilization, because I've never figured out where one civilization begins and the other one ends. He divides it up religiously. It's the Orthodox, it's the Catholics, and the Western, and he groups all the Protestants in under the Catholics, and it's Islam. And this is his three civilizations. He doesn't actually pay much attention to civilizations farther east that have nothing to do with us. So I think this Huntington's work is very superficial, and became very popular, largely because it fed the narrative about Islam being an enemy of the West. Whereas in fact, there's been a continuum. If you diverge slightly, when we had our problems in Jerusalem with the Israelis, it was the Muslims that rallied to our support rather than the Western Christians. So there isn't, I disregard the clash of civilizations. Now, in the marrow, this is Ukrainian nationalism, and there are essentially, how do you separate, how do you separate the Ukraine, which has this long history intertwined with Russia? One of them, one factor there besides language is the existence of a Ukrainian National Orthodox Church. And they didn't actually create it, by reasserting its independence and autocephaly from Moscow, you are now making it the second biggest Orthodox Church in the world after the Russian Church, even after you take them away from Russia. And also, you strengthen the position of the Orthodox Church in the Ukraine vis-a-vis the Uniates, the Byzantine Rite Catholics. So it both strengthens nationalism. It strengthens nationalism within the Ukraine by associating nationalism with Orthodoxy, and it strengthens the power of the Ukrainian government, which is trying to maintain its independence from Russian influence.
So, Ambassador, you've given us a great background and how deep and long this rivalry has gone, and this latest tension has some roots and some very fascinating drama that you were on top of. I started with the Great and Holy Synod in Crete, but a couple years ago, after the so-called coup in Turkey, correspondence or an article started circulating about the patriarch potentially being the next target of Erdogan because he was a Gulenist. And the article, the byline, had it by a former U.S. ambassador who was a colleague of yours.
Yeah.
Why don't you take us through what happened there?
Yeah, this thing pops up. It was Art Hughes, the former ambassador, allegedly wrote this article as an article in the Middle East Institute, which is one of the leading Middle Eastern think tanks in Washington. And it popped up on my desk one day, and I called Art and I said, what does this article have to do? Why'd you write it? And he had never written it. It was a fairly cleverly done hoax. They had hacked his email. They had hacked his account at the Middle East Institute. And the article was written in ways that sounded sort of plausible. So it took us a couple of days to figure out that no one in the Middle East Institute had written it. So we're
The article originated someplace abroad. We don't know. We don't have the technical skills here to figure out where. But it was clearly written in an attempt to influence the Turkish government, Erdogan's government, to regard the Ecumenical Patriarch as a Gulenist or as a friend of Gulen or as somebody who was supporting the revolution against Erdogan. I don't think the Turkish government paid that much attention to it, but then again, they've never been terribly friendly to the Patriarchate, even except for an opening at the beginning when Erdogan first took over. And now they've just reverted to the normal sort of undermining the Patriarchate, trying to make it unimportant, not allowing it to be called the Ecumenical Patriarchate. But this was clear, in my opinion, there can be no other explanation for this article other than it having originated someplace in Russia and someplace from the Russian church.
And what's a, you know, it, have you seen as a result of that article, of the controversies that arose that year and all the way through this follow-up, do you see any evidence of the Russians, especially now that they've kind of made up with Ankara and Erdogan, trying to use that relationship and trying to leverage Turkey in their fight with the Fanar?
I don't see them directly intervening in Turkey so far. I haven't seen anything. And mind you, the Russian-Turkish relationship on what's happening in Syria and the Middle East is in such flux. It goes in such flux that it's very hard for somebody to keep score on a daily basis. Where we've seen more of it has been attempts to undermine Jerusalem vis-a-vis Antioch. Antioch being much more under Russian influence than Jerusalem. Jerusalem having sort of successfully fought off Russian attempts to control the Patriarchate there. So I see Russian activity there more. I haven't seen anything in Turkey after that pertaining directly to the Patriarchate. The fact that the Russians didn't show up for the Great Council and persuaded, I think it was the Georgians, not to come either, may be part of a larger effort to simply make Constantinople less important and as the take away Constantinople's right as first among equals to call the meetings. I mean, Constantinople is supposed to call the meetings of all the Orthodox churches. Where we see the Russians operating has been so assistance given to the Antiochian church, as I said, and sort of a inability to deal with the fact that there are now more Russian Orthodox Jewish Israelis. It sounds weird, but right now there are probably 300,000 Russian Orthodox in Israel who entered Israel as Jews under the law of return. They now significantly outnumber the Arab Orthodox in Israel and Palestine. Which has left the Patriarchate there with a little bit of a problem because it doesn't have Russian. It's trying to get all its priests to learn Russian.
So you mentioned, Ambassador, that Russia is also, it has been targeting the other Patriarchates, especially in the Middle East.
Yes.
Do we see any Russian activity when it comes to our own archdiocese here in the United States? Or is it limited to the, you know, a geographic region or to Europe and the Middle East?
I've not seen anything other than the hostility of the Antiochian Church here towards the Greek Orthodox. You know, I don't know if you follow this story, but some years back, way back a long time ago, a decision was made that the Patriarchate, that all the Arab churches, Arab American churches, or churches of Arab origin in the United States, would fall under the authority of the Patriarch of Antioch. And there are a significant number of churches whose parishioners here in the United States are of Palestinian or Jordanian origin, and they did not like being under Antioch. They felt Antioch treated them badly. They wouldn't assign priests, would assign priests who didn't have any cultural contact with their communities. Jerusalem got in trouble for trying to take some of these churches back under its authority. So finally there was an agreement whereby, and I think it's 14 parishes, I may be off on the number, have been taken away from the authority of Antioch, put under the authority of the Archdiocese, of the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese, but who commemorate the Patriarch of Jerusalem. And this has made it extremely, caused a great deal of hostility between the Antiochians here and the Archdiocese, the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese. We've also had a sideshow over jurisdiction over the Orthodox churches in the Persian Gulf. Do they belong to Jerusalem or do they belong to Antioch? So it is a case of, I think the Russians support Antioch, but Antioch is a somewhat independent actor, showing a great deal of hostility towards Jerusalem, and that is a bit of a proxy for hostility towards Constantinople. On the other hand, Antioch right now is barely surviving, considering all the terrible things that are happening in Syria. Their weight on the scene is pretty weak. But right now, I see the real contest between Constantinople and Moscow being played out in Eastern Europe, in the Ukraine, and in the churches in the Baltics.
But following up on that point, on the one hand, you see the Russian Orthodox here very supportive of, let's say, an independent Orthodox church here.
Right.
Right, which would, if the Greek Orthodox went to such an independent church, that would effectively cut out Constantinople's most influential flock.
Right.
And on the other, you see, and I mean, there's a lot behind this. This is a complicated, a more complex issue than just Moscow versus Constantinople. But the ties of various monastic movements with Moscow. In fact, I think in the next couple of weeks, Ephrem from the Vatopedi is due to this in the States. He has strong diaspora connections, but as has been reported, very strong connections with Vladimir Putin. Now, there may be nothing more than Orthodox Brotherhood there, or it could be a pincer movement. And in either case, it seems that Constantinople is being undermined here. Is this something? Yeah. If I'm off base, just tell me. No, you're crazy.
No. Nobody can really come up with a rational description of what's happening. Primarily because there are so many factors that neither Constantinople nor Moscow fully control. Ephrem is a bit of a loose cannon. He is a loose cannon. And I think he tries to exploit Moscow for his purposes rather than Moscow successfully exploiting him for theirs. Clearly, if the church in America became autocephalous, or there was an Orthodox Church of America in which we and the Russians locally and the Antiochians combined into a single church, it would take away something like 80% of the parishioners of Constantinople. And it would be a real blow to Constantinople, both financially and politically. This is one of the reasons I think autocephaly would be a disaster for the Greek Orthodox element here. But the other issue is is that there are, everybody's a bit of cross purposes here. I'm not being terribly coherent sometimes, but Church of Greece, of course, is autocephalous, but it has certain ties to Constantinople. About a third of the bishops, a third of the dioceses in Greece belong to Constantinople, but are appointed by the Archbishop of Athens, like Chios in the Eastern Aegean Islands, Macedonia, and Crete. But right now, I think the Greeks have slowly, the Church of Greece, which tended, I'm always back Constantinople, but always had sort of a soft spot for Moscow, has backed away from it. Insofar as I can tell right now, they are resisting attempts by Moscow to interfere in their relationship with Constantinople.
Ambassador, besides being, you know, a very distinguished diplomat that we're all very proud of.
Flattery will get you everywhere.
Maybe some free airline tickets. No. Yeah. You know, you've guided this community and even us here at HALC, you know, for all our listeners who've been part of the, you know, the F-35 campaign, you can know we've gotten a lot of input from Patrick and a lot of intel, not classified intel, but intelligence. Yeah. But you've also observed all levels of advocacy, from the Archons to all the other groups, and it seems that a lot of the nuances and a lot of the kind of almost spy novelish drama right. that we're undergoing now is not addressed in this advocacy. And if you could give us some suggestions, as you know, religious freedom, especially in Turkey and in Eastern Europe, is getting a lot more attention here in the States, because of Andrew Brunson. But Andrew Brunson could eventually be released tomorrow. What changes do we have to make in our approaches for religious freedom, and not only of the patriarchate? I think we've missed and only recently have gotten on to the fact that if you advocate for all of Christianity in the Middle East and all religious minorities that are being targeted by the Islamic State, you lift your cause. So what changes in the approach would you advocate?
Well, clearly, I think that it takes it requires that there be more dialogue with the other ethnic groups in the United States, the religious ethnic groups, with the Armenians, with the Coptic Church here, with the Assyrians, because they are all affected. Right now, there are probably more Assyrian Orthodox in Turkey than there are Greek Orthodox. These are Nestorian, they're the descendants of the Nestorians, for example. They've been, and there are more of them in Turkey, particularly in eastern and southeastern Turkey, than there are Greek Orthodox. The same applies in Iran, which has been less of a problem. The Iranians do not allow Christianity a completely free reign, but they've actually been much more correct in applying the rules than anybody else has in the region. The Chaldeans in Detroit, for example, a very strong, partly Nestorian, partly Roman Catholic affiliated group. So building a relationship on with all the Eastern Christians who have communities here in the United States, I think, would be very important. We all share common goals. And it'll also give us a more realistic understanding of the situation. It is not a cut and dried Muslims against us situation. In Jerusalem, for example, as I noted earlier, we have a great deal of support from the Muslim community, which regards the reduction of the Christian community in Palestine as a bit of a disaster. We are a part of the fabric of life throughout the area. I do think, and this is an aside, that somehow or other this is not a main part of this discussion, but we certainly have to put our own church in order if we are going to retain influence as the single most important Orthodox church.
Ecumenical church, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Just kind of as a point of policy, because you know Washington from the inside.
Right.
You know it not only in a political sense, but you are one of the very few people who understand both politics, policy, and thought leaders, having served in each of those capacities. Right. Is the focus, and sometimes it seems like a blinder focus, is the only ask that we have. Is the focus on Halki working? Do people get it? Are we asking for the wrong thing? Because as we've analyzed here, Halki, we're right now in the 14th straight year of broken promises. No, actually 16th yeah. straight year of broken promises on Halki. And I'm wondering, especially, you know, with the question of patriarchal succession, is it a mistake not to get out there and say, no, what we really want is the Orthodox Church to pick its own patriarch, and, you know, Turkey can pound sand if they want any say in it?
Yeah, we have a little bit of a problem in that under the Treaty of Lausanne, and the Turks have the authority to veto the appointment of a patriarch. Now, they've been very capricious in that veto and insisting it has to be a Turkish citizen, stuff like that. What I would do is, personally, and I've been advocating this for a long time, is if we have difficulty in getting a proper new patriarch once Bartholomew passes on, is the new patriarch we should elect a new patriarch regardless of what Turkey wants, and then put him in exile in Washington. We've had an exile,
like a Dalai Lama situation.
Yeah, exactly. Because and there's a history for this. When the Crusaders took Constantinople in 1204, the Patriarchate moved to Nicaea for 50 or 60 years. And can you imagine the political influence and power if the Ecumenical Patriarch is temporarily ensconced in Washington, D.C., the capital of the most powerful country in the Western world? This would be a serious threat to Turkey. It would be, and I think just the threat of it would be enough to make the Turks back away. Yeah. So, I think we need that threat to materialize. The other minorities in Turkey also have their halkis. They have their own particular issues, churches, schools, and so forth. That have been undermined. I'm a little prejudiced on Halki. My grandfather was a graduate. I think it's we don't have a good theological school in the Greek part of the Orthodox Church anymore after Halki. So I think it's very important, but I would, the more people that come to the table, one of the dangers of being only focused on the Greek Orthodox Church is that it is the Greek. And we keep, and though I think it is an essential part of our identity, it runs the risk of, you're only doing this because you're Greek and it has nothing to do with religion and stuff like that. We seem to be hiding behind religion. So I see this as Greek Americans, as there is a real threat to Greece from Turkey today. We have a legitimate reason why we should do things like oppose the acquisition of the F-35. The other track is Turkey needs to step up to its role as a civilized country, as part of it wants to be part of the Western world, it wants to be part of the world community. And that we can only do, I think we can best do with an effort across all the religions that have a role to play, that have constituents in Turkey, that have a history in Turkey, and so forth. And Turks right now control a significant part of northern Syria, where there used to, I don't know if there still are any left, but there used to be a significant Christian community. And we can even go beyond that. There are other religious minorities that are not necessarily Christian. For example, the Alevi. The Alevi are they're not quite Muslim. They're not quite Christian. They're another minority in the Middle East, but there's 14 million of them in Turkey.
Yeah.
And they are as much persecuted as the Christians are. As a matter of fact, more, because there's more of them to be targeted. So I believe that a broader approach on religious freedom, in which we reach out to all these communities, will serve us much better. It can go in tandem with the with our own concerns about the threat to Greece from Turkey. And it's actually a threat to other countries in the region as well, but particularly a threat to Greece.
And I think that's a great way to end here, exactly, because that type of approach is also consistent with the core of our messaging, which is we're not a narrow interest group. We're a community that advocates for values,
right,
across the board. The rule of law is not only the rule of law in Cyprus, it's the rule of law elsewhere. Religious freedom is not only the religious freedom of the Ecumenical Patriarch. And that's why, and you nailed it, Ambassador, when we have worked together with the Armenians, we have a very close relationship with the Armenian National Committee, with the Assyrians in
demand for action,
and sure, and with In Defense of Christians, we get more stuff done. Now, thank you for taking time. We look forward.
It's my pleasure.
We look forward to having you back, because we'd like to, since you referred to it, talk a bit about the state of the church in Jerusalem. And we'd also want you to put your Middle East hat on. And as Idlib happens, and certain other gyrations occur in the Middle East, we'd like to get your expert analysis. But thank you for
more than happy
always having your line open to us.
Okay, take care of yourselves.
Thanks again. That wraps up this week's episode. Make sure to tune in again next week to the Greek Current podcast. Follow us on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts. You can find us on any platform now.